Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. It's Chris and Jason back again with special guests from France to talk about the continuing struggle over the French pension reforms. If you remember last time, our old friend and comrade Matthew joined us from Paris. And this time we have an actual real-ass French person joining us as well. Say hello, Julia.
Hi. Bonjour.
So,
that means nobody can ever take issue with anything that's said because this is spoken from a French person's perspective.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. Yes, we can replace our ersatz French person with a real French person this time. But anyway, so we were talking about the French pension reforms last time, and before we get into what's going on now, would you guys like to get us caught up with what happened since the last episode? Because it's been about a month, and that was before the pension reform was actually passed. It was just threatening.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to believe it's been a month already. I think what happened and what surprised most people, me included, is that I think the last time you recorded that episode, the reform was going to be examined by the Constitutional Council, and they were supposed to give the decision. Can't remember exactly when it happened. And so there was this great expectation, you know, like, and everyone thought, well, something will happen no matter what decision they take. Either, you know, things are going to completely blow up and people will just like literally start a revolution if they decide to actually pass the reform, or if they actually decide not to pass it, there will be this like explosion of joy or something. And then it happened. They eventually decided to pass the reform, but nothing happened. Like there was, it's like this big bubble that just like, well, you know, dissolved. That was very strange. It was a very strange moment, as if suddenly people was just exhausted and tired and demoralized, really.
There was also when they passed the Constitutional Council, then there was, what was it, like 24, how long did Macron have to sign it into law? So basically the idea is that the government introduces a law. In this case, the legislature didn't vote on it. They invoked 49.3, so they bypassed the legislature. Right. And then goes to the Constitutional Council, which kind of functions in this case like the Supreme Court in the United States, and says, has this been done according to the rules? Is it a constitutional gesture by the government? Incidentally, they didn't approve all of it. They just approved all of it that mattered in terms of changing the retirement law or raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. And then once it passes that stage, the president has X amount of time to pass it. I can't remember how long.
I don't remember exactly if he has like a specific, like basically the president has to sign off on the law. And this is what he does on a daily basis with every law that is voted in France. But obviously this one was much more important. And the decision, the Constitutional Council made the decision on the Friday at 5 p.m. And then there was weekend and Macron announced that he was going to finally meet with the unions the next week on Monday or Tuesday. So we thought, okay, maybe he's like ready to at least start a conversation or something. But then he actually signed off on the law in the nights and on Friday night, like in the night between Friday and Saturday. And the Journal Officiel, the official journal, published the pension reform, the law, the next morning. So there was like a last blow in a way. Was like the final insult.
I can see that being very demoralizing.
Yeah. And that was before meeting with the unions?
That was before meeting with the unions. So there was really like it was extremely insulting.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But I think what's really surprised me, I mean, I work like my place of work is quite close to the Constitutional Council, and I was really expecting things to go really badly that day. But again, nothing happened. I think people were just, as I said before, completely demoralized. And Yeah.
That sort of reminds me of in Texas in 2013, there was a restriction on abortion bill that was up before the Texas legislature, and you know, a bunch of people occupied the Capitol and kept the vote from going through. The time for it to be signed off on or, you know, voted through was expired. And everyone was like, yay, victory. And they all left. And as soon as they left, when it was back in session, they just put it through while there was nobody in the Capitol. That very demoralizing. And then pretty much since then, there's been no kind of movement to speak of in Texas regarding reproductive rights or anything.
Right.
It just completely flattened it. And then the woman who led the movement from the floor of the legislature ran for governor and was absolutely annihilated. You know, that was the nail in the coffin of the movement then. So, yeah, it's like I think that a lot of people assume that heavy-handedness on behalf of the government, the state, will inspire like anger and revolt. And in a lot of cases, it just demoralizes people and then and shows them that really they are, for the most part, pretty powerless to do anything.
Yeah. Although apparently the last month or so since that law passed, things have been a little bit rowdy in France. Mm-hmm. Like there's been some kind of response at least.
Yeah. No, so I think like to Chris's point, just in to provide like a, say the perspective of a political scientist or a historian. So it's true. Like that sort of like Macron's move there was tactical, and it was probably the best thing that he could do. Cause from this point on, he has to maneuver very, very carefully. If he somehow opened this up for public participation, it could have been a disaster.
Right.
So heavy-handedness on the government, yeah, typically demoralizes people, where people usually make gains, which has been true, I think, at least for the past long time, maybe over the course of modern history, but it's when governments make blunders.
Right.
So what comes, I mean, this is the European context, and to just an example that comes to mind is the DDR opening the border in 1989. You know, it's just a sort of like fumbling of the government. It's like, well, I guess we're going to just open the border now. And suddenly there's this massive interjection of public participation, and it brings down the entire government and then the state. So, so Macron has to be tactical, and he has to be very, very careful, because in the time since then, let's say I wouldn't characterize it as a victory lap, but he did go around the country with trying to sort of, shall we say, like smooth feathers, to use an English expression, to be somewhat conciliatory and to sort of like, okay, this is in the past now, let's move forward. And he hasn't been able to go anywhere, because every time he shows up in a public space, people show up with pots and pans. And that's been the latest thing, is like disrupting him in his public appearances and trying to put a lid on the pension reform and say, okay, and put it in the past, right? And people through public demonstrations have been keeping that dial or that debate, shall we say, in the public space open. That culminated with, well, no, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves to May 9th, because there's May Day, which happens in between then, but go ahead.
Right.
Yeah, maybe what I can, it's true that he decided to like, you know, go through different like small towns and villages in France to, I think, try to pretend that he was close to the people, because he had been criticized so much over the past few months for like being distant, for being completely absent of this reform, like being in power, in charge of everything, but just like, you know, pushing his government and his prime minister to the front line to really, to sacrifice them in a way. And then he decided to go on his tour, and he was indeed like, and I think maybe I should just add actually something. I remember that you said like in the last episode that, people like his close collaborators call him and refer to him as Jupiter. I think there was a discussion in your past episode about this. And he really, yeah, this is who he is. Like, he's above everyone else. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's been welcome with like pots and pans and people like just using literally, yeah, kitchen pots to demonstrate and to, and the crazy thing is that following these incidents, let's say with the air quotes, the police decided to forbid people to bringing pots and pans into the streets. Right. So you're not allowed to bring your kitchen pot down in the street.
Right.
It's insane.
Right. So the way that they're navigating that public objection is literally through just I think I can just say brute force. I think the idea is like, no, you can't demonstrate, you can't express an opinion. Shut up.
Well, that's bound to make him more popular.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Yeah.
But that's been the response to the discontent, which is just like, shut the fuck up, you know?
Yeah.
Go home. You can't criticize, you can't critique.
Tell me if I'm off base here, but like when I see how poorly Macron is doing in the polls, like how unpopular he is, I see like an inversely proportionate chance of victory from Marine Le Pen in the future, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So that's the cudgel that the center, that Macron center is like holding over French society, is that if you don't get up with my program, you know, I'm going to call in Marine. He's not going to call her in, but this is the alternative. Right. Either you accept this shitty deal, and like I said, shut up and go home, or you risk having to deal with Rassemblement National, which is the old Front National,
right?
The old FN. We talked about this. They've reinvented themselves.
They're post-fascist now.
Post-fascist.
Yeah.
That's the other tactic of the government, which it's just sort of like, you know, it's like either accept our brute force or accept the brute force of the fascists. I think one of the thing is that reveals is that the fraud of centrist politics in the face of a rising fascist movement is that even though the way French politics or the way French government is organized through the elections is you have a first round for presidential elections and then the second round, for the past two elections, that's pitted Macron against Marine Le Pen. In both times, Macron has won. But only because it's either, you know, accept this guy and his shitty program or what's worse. And so far, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to say rightly or wrongly, but so far French voters have said like, fine, they've held their noses and they've accepted Macron, to keep Marine Le Pen out of government.
I think that has a lot to do, from what I understand anyway, with an enthusiasm gap, right? It is holding off an enthusiasm gap. That's what I mean. With repeated fiascos that like the ones that Macron has been like presiding over, you could see that enthusiasm gap getting like wider and wider. Mm-hmm. So at some point it's conceivable that Le Pen could win as a result of that, as centrism just fumbles the ball constantly. Mm-hmm. It's similar to the situation that you have over there. Sounds a whole hell of a lot like the situation with Donald Trump and whichever gray neoliberal blob they put up to run against him. The Republicans are ghouls. Do you want the Republicans to win? If you don't vote for this Democrat who is completely
utterly uninspiring,
utterly uninspiring, and in most ways identical to the person they're running against, then you're going to get the slightly worse ghoul, you know. I don't know. I think maybe the difference between Le Pen and Macron is greater than most Republicans and most Democrats. But
And like one big thing that's different is that in France, there's also, I mean, it's definitely less of a chance, but there's always still the specter of a Mélenchon as a distinct you know possibility, even if it's much less likely.
Yeah. Well, that's the other I don't want to get too far ahead of the story, but there's the specter of fascism, the specter of Marine Le Pen or post fascism or whatever you want to call it. But there's also, he also does the same thing with Mélenchon as just sort of tarring him with an extremist, you know, it's either accept me.
Yeah.
I'm the alternative to the two extremes.
Well, and like in that's the Anglophone press, there's been lots of different sort of like post-Mélenchon kind of thinking. There's a lot of commentary about like the French left's Mélenchon problem and like the reason why Mélenchon's no good. And it seems as though that specter is becoming a little bit more serious. And again, from far away, from over here, that's what it looks like anyways.
Yeah.
But that is, I guess that is a little bit ahead of the story. Yeah.
Another thing about the Anglophone press that it refuses to couch it as anything but a democratic decision, right? Like, right, according to the Anglophone press, the French government democratically decided on passing this pension reform. They don't talk about it like it's a decree, which is it's essentially what it is a decree, right?
Right. Yeah.
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 So the way that the Anglophone press is talking about it is like the government did its job, democratically decided on this or that, and a bunch of whiny union members are upset about it and causing a stink. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, and if you're in the United States, then like that's the way the press talks about all strikes or union activity.
Right, yeah, crybaby is who can't accept reality or whatever.
Yeah, it's like the narrative, the meme narrative is that like French people are, you know, so lazy that they're expected to work like a couple more hours a week and they're freaking out about it, or they're a couple more years, where in the United States, we don't even have that, you know, no one here even retires.
And you guys are doing just fine.
I know. It's like, guys, you guys are such bootlicking cowards, just like an entire nation of servile idiots.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's how I feel. I know that's not, but I would say that the conservatives in this country and most of the Democrats are servile bootlicking idiots. Absolutely.
Right. The thing is, definitely. the French aren't, I would say.
Yeah.
And this is the thing about Macron and why they're so upset about it, is that it almost the argument almost transcends just the constitutional processes, the 49.3 thing, et cetera. It goes back to the way this man was elected, which was just like the last, I don't know, resort. The alternative being Marine Le Pen. So like, fine, you accept Macron. Macron he's never been a tremendously popular man. Even though there was enthusiasm for him, I think in the first, especially on the international.
They loved him over here.
Yeah. But there was, so when he started his presidency, he was maybe above 50% of the polls. I don't know exactly what it was, but there was, I suppose, support for him, but that's dwindled away consistently over the course of his term in office and became dangerously low before COVID-19 with the yellow jacket thing. But to the point that the constitutional reform transcends democratic procedure, et cetera, is that the man never had a mandate to mess with the French social contract in the first place.
Yeah.
Right. Now, to be clear, he was elected on that platform, or that's what he said he was going to do. But again, he got into office not because he was going to reform the French social system or whatever. It was because people didn't want Marine Le Pen. Okay.
No, I mean, I think the first time he was elected, he was definitely very popular. He was young. He was apparently good looking, according to some people. He was,
compared to other politicians, you know, it's all relative.
I'd say he was young, and even though one of the problems that he never had a mandate, he was never elected to the parliament. He was never mayor. He used to be a private banker that joined the previous government, and that was it. But he managed to present himself as someone who was both bringing, you know, like he was going to bring like social reforms and bring the best of the left and the right together.
Oh yeah, that sounds wonderful.
We see how that works.
That always works out.
Yeah.
And since then, he's also like, you know, he's brokered peace between Russia and Ukraine, and he's done so much stuff. You know, he's really responsible for a lot.
Yeah. Well, so do you remember? Yeah. I just remember the image of like when he was going to go like talk to Putin. And there was Putin had this big, long white table, and it was like Putin at one end of the table. Did you guys see this in the
States?
Yeah,
yeah.
Macron was down at the other end, you know, like a meeting of the minds or whatever. And of course, the reason was it was during COVID-19.
Yeah.
And so they didn't want to get close, but you could tell, like, you know, they also
liberal press in this country, like, really made a big deal out of the fact that Putin was observing COVID social distancing to show that he was like a coward.
But where does that leave us? So that's a constitutional council, mm-hmm. and then his little tour. Oh, he did the he was on the news, but it was only like in daytime television when.
Oh yeah, that was this as well. He decided to address the people on television, but it did it. I think, I don't know, it was like 1 or 2 p.m. in the afternoon on a mm-hmm. weekday when, you know,
obviously everyone's at work.
Where people at work? People who are the most concerned about this reform are not watching the television. Right. So that was weird.
Yeah. The audience was specifically people like retirees, people who had already retired. So that was a good one.
Yeah, that's very brave.
But again, very careful. I mean, again, he's being very, very conscious, I think, about his public, the way he's presenting himself, or the exposure, I should say, the way he's limiting people's exposure to him, or even their ability to criticize him.
Yeah, there was also this football game, which he attended, and I don't remember exactly the nature of the event, but it was a football game. And normally he would have entered the stadium and, like, you know, welcome all the players and, like, shake hands with them. But he decided not to do it and instead went to meet the players in the locker room, prior to the game, because he was afraid of being booed by the public.
Right.
Which also tells a lot about what he's ready to do and not ready to face. No way.
Right.
Yeah. Well, like, I forget who now. Somebody was calling for a referendum, like, put the pension reform to a vote, like, to a popular vote. And I'm sure you know more about that, but that's not even being considered.
Yeah, I mean, what happened also, like, when the reform was started by the Constitutional Council, there were also a series of motions or proposals from various parliamentary groups, mostly from the left and also the far right, actually. And one of them was to organize this referendum, and it was,
it was dismissed.
Yeah,
as being non-procedural, basically. The idea there was to sort of gum up the works at a parliamentary level, I suppose. That's not the right word, but to. To delay, I suppose, because you would have had to have gotten a certain number of signatures from the public to go forward with it. Not that I doubt that could have happened, but in any event, the Constitutional Council decided that it was untoward or it wasn't in due process. So that didn't go.
That's not a big surprise.
No, but it wasn't at all clear. I think we should say that it wasn't at all clear which way the Constitutional Council would go. There are people on that council that we know detest Macron. And we won't know how it voted until, what, like 20 years from now or something like that, that'll be released to the public record who voted which way on this particular law.
Not that it really matters, because they will all be dead.
They'll be dead by then. It's a problem living in societies run by geriatrics. But
yeah, there were some great expectations, because the president of the council, Laurent Fabius, who was a former socialist prime minister, very openly detests Macron. And, you know, although he's supposed to be impartial, there was the hope that maybe this will influence the decision, but apparently not.
Yeah.
I think something that was also interesting to me is how, at least I can speak for myself, how suddenly this kind of like institutional decision was really followed by people, like in France, most media like Le Monde and others actually published the official text, like the decision from the Constitutional Council, and people read it. Like, it's not something that you would normally do, I think, that most people would normally do, but suddenly it became this like hot topic of getting to actually dig in this legal text and trying to understand the every details, and
right,
it was quite interesting.
There was a
that seems remarkable to me too.
Yeah. there was a cartoon that was going around online that was like two parents that had just had a newborn baby, or I guess not a newborn, but in any event, the idea was like, honey, you know, our child has just said his first words. And the response is, did he have anything to say on the constitutional reform or the pension reform? The idea was that a child should already be speaking about the pension reform. Anyway, whatever. Okay. Take that shit out. Didn't go over. Okay. You get it, right? What is the joke? It was, you know,
I was waiting for the punchline, and then I realized
the punchline was that the parent, yeah, right, asked if the baby was talking about the constitutional or the pension reform. That's the problem. I flubbed it.
Oh yeah, I mean, okay. I got it.
Moving on. So then I think the next thing is May Day. No.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go start with May Day, or do you want me to?
Sure. So then May Day happened, and there was a big success. You know, like, I think there's so more people joining the various demonstrations across France than, you know, since many years. I think it felt good, actually, to suddenly see the people going to the streets in both, like, a like demonstrating, but also like celebrating. We went, we joined the demonstration in Paris. We went there with a couple of friends and their actually 3-year-old child. And there was a lot of, it was very festive in some ways. And it felt really good to suddenly feel this, like, you know, solidarity. But we decided to leave the demo before the end because we knew that things were going to get bad at the end, and it, you know, actually did. I think you also mentioned it last time. It's also what's really emerged in the past few months. It's the police violence, which have become really systemic in France, and how they've implemented this strategy of like scaring people in such a way that people will not go to the streets to demonstrate. And it didn't disappoint. You know, the demonstration in Paris and in other cities in France ended with like pretty harsh violence. You know, buildings were set on fire, trash cans were set on fire.
Is this when they occupied the stock exchange?
No, that happened just before. Before May Day. Yeah.
Which was, it seemed like it would have been a bigger deal than it was, but I guess they.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about the May Day, the lead up into the May Day. It's like, okay, so the Constitutional Council decision was demoralizing and disappointing. Maybe not surprising, but demoralizing and disappointing.
Anyway. Right.
There were lots of actions leading up into May Day, which become relevant when you talk about the police's participation or the repression of the May Day march. One of the things that happened, I believe, if I'm getting my chronology correct, was that in what's that financial district outside of Paris?
La Défense.
Which is where the French Stock Exchange is.
Like the city.
It's a city just outside of Paris. It's the way that Paris or the French have differentiated this capitalist problem of having your government in the same place as your financial hub, you know, which Paris is because... Yeah. So they moved finance just a little bit out of the city to separate money from politics. It's not a huge country, you know, so you got to, they did what they could. Anyway, so they moved it outside the city. That's where the stock exchange was stormed. That in and of itself is a pretty big deal. And at least, I mean, in the sense of like, yeah, that's what you do. You know what I mean? In this age
right,
of like.
Exactly. That's how you know, protest.
That's how you protest. The problem, I mean, not to say that there was a problem, but the limits on that where they weren't able to interrupt trading, they managed to get into the lobby before being forced out. I think they were forced out. I actually don't know how that all went down, but it happened. Now, when you get to May Day, so you have these demonstrations that were happening consistently leading up into the May Day demonstration. These official rallies that are called by government or by political parties and unions have a kind of like, they're very, how does one say they're, and I don't want to say like they're full of themselves, but these are very sort of like grandiose moments of like, yes, and now we will call on the people, you know, to participate or whatever, in like the official march or something like that. But it doesn't be confused. There were other actions and demonstrations happening consistently on a daily basis, I believe, going up into that point. Now, May Day, the union estimates were 2.3 million people marching in France. The wow. police estimates were much lower, as you can imagine. But that's a lot of, I mean, even
having, yeah, but even a much lower estimate is still like, you know, a million or so.
Right. Even the low estimates, it were seven times as many people as had demonstrated the previous May Day. That was the low end, were seven times as many. The high was 10 times as many. And it was also like one of those demonstrations where we can remember, or Jason, Chris, and I can remember from like the immigrants' rights marches in 2006, where it's just like, it's just a lot of fucking people, you know? Like, you don't know how big it is. You just know it ain't small, you know? It was one of those marches.
Yeah, that immigrants' rights march was the biggest one that I've ever been in. And I think it was something like 40,000 people.
Right. This was, there's a bigger.
Yeah. Well, 40,000 people in Austin is a lot.
Huge. Yeah. I remember like the march snaking around a building, and you could look back and see where it was still just beginning. And this was one of the, we arrived, I think, a little bit later because we were trying to coordinate with our friends. And we were like 2 hours late, and the march was still leaving the square. So it was big.
Well, yeah. I think the largest demo I ever went to was, it was May Day, and it was in Caracas. It was in Venezuela. Right. And it was just a celebration, you know, because Hugo Chavez came to speak at it. And a million people came to that. But it's still like a third of what you experienced.
Right, right. Yeah. It's also true that it was combative. I think May Days that I've experienced in Europe are usually just like big parties. Like people are grilling out in the streets and stuff, which is good. Right. It's how it should be. This was it was a lot more tense. But it had some great moments. I remember like people hanging out the windows, like as you're marching through these boulevards and there are apartments on either side and there are people like waving from the stoops, you know, or not the stoops, but the balconies. It was fun. It had a good energy. It was mixed with a sense of tension and danger because the longer it went on, the more dangerous it became, or the more risk you ran of running into the police.
It's funny because the story about the storming the stock exchange did not really, I don't know, I don't remember this.
It happened.
I don't think it was such a big deal in a way.
Well, again, I don't think, because it was a big deal in the sense that I think that it was, that's where you ought to go. And these are the people you ought to be targeting. I think it wasn't a big deal because they only managed to get into the lobby.
Okay.
But that being said, there's been, I think I would say, a concerted media campaign to draw people's attention away, which was not successful at first. I think it's become more successful. Say like in the weeks since May Day, I think even like, you know, like with the Coronation, Cannes Film Festival, whether or not Johnny Depp is an asshole, like all of these things are just like little by little supposed to, you know, draw people's attention back to the.
Are they still talking about that there?
Johnny Depp?
Yeah.
Well, he was at Cannes. He was at don't get us distracted because this is what they want. They want to think about Johnny Depp.
I haven't heard about Johnny Depp in a while. I was very happy about that.
Yeah. Now he's in a movie that incidentally is set in the Ancien Regime under Louis XV, with a reactionary director. But you know,
he's actually playing Louis XV.
He plays Louis
XV. Kind of funny. Yeah.
They didn't have any French people that could do that.
Yeah, you know. Well, apparently
I said it was available, but they didn't call me back.
The first choice was Gérard Depardieu, which is also kind of ironic because he's also facing rape charges.
Is he?
Yeah.
Nice.
So Johnny Depp is in France. He attended the premiere of the film at the Cannes Festival, and there has been this big polemic about, you know, why to choose him. And
we can sum it up by saying that all rich people and celebrities are assholes and whatever. Moving on.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so I guess where we were was
May Day.
May Day proper, because we were almost to May Day, and then I distracted us talking about the stock exchange being stormed, which unfortunately they only got in the lobby. They didn't burn the joint down. So May Day.
Yeah. So then I think finally people had, even though again these big demonstrations called by the unions, etc., are a little bit full of themselves, I guess is the expression I'm looking for, you know. But I think it provided a way for people to participate in the debate that they had been looking for. And that's why you saw this massive turnout. Now, in terms of whatever the numbers actually were, if the unions are reporting 2.3 million, and it's an impossible really to verify it, all anyone can say, which is like a lot of people, that tells me that they're looking for, shall we say, I don't know if you want to call it a cover, a mandate, a reason to keep the debate open. If it was just like, yeah, I mean, either, does that make sense? It's like, I don't think they're trying to tie a bow on it. Just so, yeah, look, all these people disagree with this or whatever. But the fact that that many people turned out, but the fact that the union's reporting those numbers suggests that there's still more to come on this question, to my mind. Now, I don't want to go into making predictions, but I don't think it's over.
Right. Well, right.
McCone still has 4 more years left as president.
That long?
Well, is there not like there's an official demo for June 6th that's planned also, right?
And there's the demo for June 6th coming up, right? So we'll see. Now, look, I don't think that I will make the prediction that we're probably not going to see 2.3 million people on the streets or whatever, but I will make the prediction that it will also be large, you know, that the anxiety, the anger, and the momentum that built up into the pension reform will carry over into the summer. So that's coming up. And then what else? I remember what I was going to say about May Day. Now, here's the thing about the actions, like where there was at the stock exchange, there were a lot of environmental demonstrations that got a lot of attention happening around the country at the same time. The police were out in force for May 1st. At the end of the day, when we left, we cut out the march early before it got to its destination, because that's where shit always goes down. And we so two things. One, we had a 3-year-old with us. Also, I'm 42 and my feet hurt, you know, so we cut out early. But even when we got back, you could hear things still happening in the streets and sirens and there's flashbang grenades and stuff like that. We're still going on. We turned on the news. There were news reporting significant events in major French cities. And I think at that time, even they were saying that as many as like 200 police casualties, which is a high figure. One police officer got caught by a Molotov.
Oh, wow.
Of course, that was all over the news. There were some, like Julia mentioned, buildings set on fire. There were fire bombings. And a lot of people, a lot of police officers got hurt, which is rare. And then, of course, these polemics about who's responsible for the violence. Is it the Black Bloc? Is it the unions? Is it the politicians? Whatever, like all of that's happening. Now, why I think this is relevant or significant was oftentimes what happened or what accounts for those high police casualties were the police themselves. Now, that's not like I'm not trying to shift the blame because I could give a shit if a cop gets hurt. But I think the police were tired. Up to the point of exhaustion from having to manage the country in the months leading up until this big demo, so that by the time they got there, they were making a lot of mistakes. So a lot of police gassed themselves, or they threw a gas canister and they gassed other groups of police. There was this one telling moment, I think, in my opinion, where a flashbang grenade went off. In a group of police, like a little cohort, you know, of police officers all with their shields locked or whatever. And so there was this big question, it's like, who threw an explosive device to the police? You know, was it Black Bloc, whoever? And it turns out what it was a police officer had tried to take a grenade and lob it at a group of protesters, but he missed his throw. And it slipped out of his hands and just kind of like flyballed straight up and came right back down in his own group. So, and went off. And so you see this, like one guy definitely hits the ground hard. 5 other police officers go down and they all pull each other down with them. And the point I'm making there is that they were making mistakes because they were tired.
Yeah.
Now that's conjecture on my part. I haven't heard anybody from the police, you know, syndicates or unions saying like, yes, we were tired, we were exhausted or whatever. But I think that was...
Oh, cops don't make mistakes.
Well, right. Cause the other explanation is just that they were dumb.
Right. Yeah. So the point is when people were talking about France being brought to the brink of insurrection, leading up into the May Day thing, that the police were having to take care of that. And I think that by the time we got to that demonstration, they had exhausted themselves and were making a lot of errors. Then, of course, after that, you had debates in the National Assembly about, like, I mean, one guy was talking about, you know, Mélenchon showed up at the May Day march and he was wearing a leather jacket, and this parliamentarian's like, yes, and he would have looked very, very good in the 1930s in his leather jacket, you know, which had been very opportune for him, which we know is exactly what he wants or something. But again, an allusion to totalitarianism or extremism. The funny thing about that is then the same deputy went on to complain that nobody took parliamentary procedure seriously anymore, you know?
Well, how could they? If only Mélenchon wears a leather jacket, you know?
Yeah, right. It's like you literally just got on national television, you know, to complain about what somebody wore to a demo, and then you're upset that no one takes you seriously. But interestingly, again, and I think this speaks to not only Macron's lack of popularity, but the climate of the country, is that regardless of whatever these struggles between political parties and factions, everybody was agreed that the problem was the government, the way the government had introduced the law, handled the law, and provoked French society or the French people into these expressions of anger, and that if anything or anyone was responsible for the violence, it was the government. That, I think, is pretty telling. Usually, I think in let's just say, I don't know, democracy and liberal democracies or whatever, people in government in particular, you know, they'll find a scapegoat, they'll blame Black Bloc, I don't know what, you know, decry the violence or whatever. I think it's rather telling that everybody zeroed in on Macron, his government, and their behavior.
Yeah, that kind of makes me wonder about, you know, the future, you know, and just like what else might be as a result, like, yeah, as a response, you know, maybe people will finally, I don't want to say finally vote for Le Pen, but yeah, maybe people are finally going to give Le Pen a chance just to get rid of the pension reform.
Well, yeah, I think this is the big risk. And unfortunately it will probably happen. Something else has happened in the past couple of weeks. We saw a series of demonstrations from fascist and neo-Nazi groups happening in several French cities, including in Paris. Especially one demonstration was really, I mean, shocking, to say the least, where this group of men marched in the street, like, wearing masks and hoodies and black hoods.
Yeah.
Which is something that is actually illegal. You're not supposed to demonstrate and hide your face in a way in this kind of political demonstration.
Oh, really? And,
yeah, I think.
Do the leftists do that there? Like the Black Bloc? Do they cover their face and stuff?
You might see people cover their faces when the tear gas starts flying, but no, usually people don't do that. Like you do in the United States, you don't see the bandanas and the people mask.
Yeah.
Really? Huh.
I mean, it was really like, there was like more like a, and they marched, you know, holding swastikas and holding, like, I mean, it's not something that you see on a regular basis in the cities, in the streets of Paris. And apparently there was several men who were kind of following the demonstration, not really actively part of it, but like just walking along it. And two of them used to be collaborators of Marine Le Pen. And she apparently immediately denounced the march and said that she was distancing herself from these people, as I think a sign of also trying to appear more, sorry, this is very hard to concentrate. There's an adorable kitten.
Sorry. Just trying to climb up my leg.
Yeah, she was trying to distance herself from the most extreme members of her own party, of her own movement, which is very clearly a sign of like trying to appear more,
reasonable,
acceptable,
post-fascist.
There you go.
Exactly. So this happened, and it seems to be really part of an ongoing movement of the far right and the really far, far right, becoming more and more important. There was a series of very interesting article in this independent online media called Mediapart about certain figures in the fascist movements, apparently managing to bring together various smaller movements and try to unionize them in a way, or making them forming a network. And this is apparently something that is taking more and more importance at the moment. And the last thing, there was also the mayor of a small town who was attacked. A group of neo-Nazis tried to set his house on fire and burn this car down because he had, basically take measures to maintain this center welcoming migrants in his town, and they were just protesting against it, and he was physically attacked, and they basically tried to kill him by setting his house on fire. And the government took a while to respond and express support.
Because to Julia's point, you have to remember that what we said at the beginning was that this is happening while people aren't being allowed to go out on the street with pots and pans to interrupt Macron, because they're creating a public nuisance. But at the same time, Nazis are marching, or allowed to march, by the police. And I think the number in Paris was 600. And again, numbers. I don't know if that was the police number or anybody else's, but whatever the estimate of the people marching was 600. And so there was a big scandal in Paris of listen, you're not letting people go out and protest or voice their discontent over Macron and his presidency, but you're going to let the Nazis, march through, it was Saint-Germain-des-Prés, which is downtown Paris,
Paris Saint-Germain, are they located in that area?
Paris Saint-Germain-des-Prés?
Is the football team, is that where they're
focus is? Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Because they have a famously fascist following.
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
Yeah. And Saint-Germain-des-Prés is just, it's a city center, and it's this former intellectual literary neighborhood.
Yeah, it's like the Left Bank. It's where May 68 happened, but now it's where, I don't know, rich people hang out and tourists.
Really?
Anyway, whatever. But anyway, so they march to the Saint-Germain-des-Prés, 600 fascists. They're allowed to do it. The police give them the go-ahead, while at the same time keeping people away from protesting against Macron or banging their pots and pans. The other, I don't want to just go from that incident into something rather funny, but it was on May 9th. No, so that happened on May 9th. And it was part of the fascist movement trying to, I don't know, because you got VE Day, which is a big deal here in Europe.
Right.
Which is also May 9th. And they're trying to rebrand May 9th. They're trying to brand the day after that anyway, with the death of some far right leader who kicked it back in the 90s or something like that. But so they're marching in support of this guy or whatever. So on VE Day, normally there's a parade, a commemoration of the end of the war.
There's a small parade indeed, and the president usually go up the Champs-Élysées to bring flowers under the Arc de Triomphe, where there is the famous grave of the anonymous.
Unknown soldier.
Thank you. And what they did again is that because they were afraid of people protesting and expressing their disagreement with Macron, they just completely shut down the entire neighborhood, the entire avenue. So people were not allowed to access the Champs-Élysées and to actually attend this commemoration, this event. So Macron just like was in a car and just like went all the way up to the top of the avenue in a completely empty, and you have to imagine that this is absolutely gigantic, you know, gigantic era. It was completely absurd. It was surreal.
Oh wait, is that the picture that you sent me, Matthew?
Yeah. It's like Macron and the Republican Guard, and that's it.
Yeah, and it's usually like pathetic. The streets are lined with people, right?
Yeah.
This is like one of the attenders. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that looks really pathetic. It looks looks absurdly comical, just how empty the street is. Yeah.
Right. It is. That's exactly, absurdly comical is a good way to describe it.
It sort of echoes the Putin's victory parade with the one T-34.
Oh, right. Yeah, because the only tank they have left.
Yeah. It actually kind of made me sad that they couldn't come up with more than one T-34. Right. There's bound to be more than one T-34 in all of Russia, right?
I would imagine.
Anyway, yeah. But
I think
they're having a hard time.
It will be interesting to see what happens also on July 14th, which is always, you know, there's always this big celebration and you know, all the various armies like marching down the Champs-Élysées, and this is, you know, this big celebration and so on, and thousands of people usually attend this. So I'm curious to see what will happen and how the government will decide to deal with this.
Right. It's a Bastille Day.
Bastille Day.
Bastille Day. Yeah.
For our non-French listeners.
Yeah, so but that's to the point about, again, the way the government, Macron's government, is using fascism as a threat. You know, it's like the Nazis can march through the city. It's not an explicit endorsement of fascism. It doesn't have to be. It's just say, like this still exists. This is a threat. You know, get on board. And I guess, I don't know, you know, except or maybe everything will be okay. I'm your last hope, you know.
Well, it sort of makes you wonder, like, is that the reason they're letting fascists march openly in the street while they're trying to keep people from clanging in pots and pans?
Precisely. They're reminding people that this is the alternative, to get on board, because otherwise you're going to have to deal with this shit. No, that's in my opinion, again, I'm speculating, but I think that's precisely what they're doing. I think that's the ploy. Because again, the government has to be very, very strategic. You can't like put Macron, obviously he can't go in public, you know? So they've got to find other ways to keep people in line. And that's one of them.
Yeah. Makes sense.
It's strategic. It's probably a blunder. We were talking about Mediapart, which is this independent journal. And I can't remember if I read this there or somewhere else, but you have to remember also in Germany, for example, you cannot, we're talking about masks at a demonstration. We lived in Berlin for 5 years. One thing you cannot do is, even in a joke, is make, for example, a Hitler, a Nazi salute or something like that. They'll arrest you quickly. Idiot tourists do it at the Brandenburg Gate and get arrested very, very quickly. You know, it's literally against the law. France doesn't have anything like that. You can't have a swastika in Berlin, for example, or all of Germany. It's literally illegal, even though you have the AfD, the alt-right, or whatever, having rebrand themselves to be palatable to an electorate. You can't be legally a Nazi.
Yeah, they march with the old imperial flag, but not the Nazi flag.
Yeah, the imperial tricolor, red, black, and white.
France doesn't have that. France doesn't have these kind of legal boundaries against fascism or extreme right movements. Even though
the birthplace of fascism doesn't even have any laws against fascism.
Right. See, that's right. Even though given the history of the country, is that probably should, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that. The other thing, well, I don't know. I don't want to move on too quickly. If there's something else on that.
We're going to do an episode eventually one of these days about proto-fascism, and it's pretty much all set in France, right?
But
for those people who might have thought that I was thinking of Italy, no, I'm thinking of France, and there are reasons for this. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just interjecting so as to head off criticism from maybe one person on the Discord or something.
You mean Italy?
What did you mean by that? Gotta cut that shit out, man. Can't be having people ask me questions. I'm just kidding. Sorry.
I think for me, like going forward, again, I hadn't thought about Bastille Day. That's a good one, because that's a big public holiday. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And then we've got it's June 6th is the next big one. I think it's D-Day. Is it not? I don't know. I think there's
big celebrations on D-Day in France. Well,
not especially, like, for certain, like, anniversaries, yes, but yeah. I don't think that every year there is a big
I have to check that it's June 6th. I'm pretty sure it is, because I'm wondering to myself if this isn't also like the left trying to put its stamp on the demonstrations to the exclusion of the right. So like the big one after the passing of the law was May Day, mm-hmm. Which is the labor left holiday, you know. And
yeah.
And then I wouldn't surprise me if, like, choosing June 6th when the D-Day invasion landings happened wasn't, again, as a way of sort of excluding the extreme right from a voice.
It is June 6th. One way. Like,
yeah, that's the next big demo? Yeah. I bet you that's got to be intentional, right? I don't know. Anyway, I would do that if I were calling these marches.
Yeah.
On sixes, I think that's the next... The next big question is the Sixth Republic and the Sixth Constitution. I think there's all kinds of reasons why French people will say that this is something that's necessary, but at the same time, something that no one's prepared to do. Right. But as Julia was talking about, like, this Jupiter character, this person, this president who has an enormous amount of power, and if the man's just going to issue mandates in place of going through the legislature, or, I don't know, behaving democratically, then that's the answer, is to pass a new constitution, which is something that happens fairly regularly in France. Because this would be their sixth since 1789, I guess, mm-hmm. The sixth constitution, which would somehow this issue of your, or the, I should say, not your, the king president or something like that. Because the constitution that de Gaulle came up with, which is, and I think at the time was said, it's like he's managed to successfully wed republicanism with monarchy, which is to say you have a very strong executive.
Bonapartism. Napoleon already did that. And he did it better too.
Yeah.
Did it with more style anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
One day we'll have to get into an argument about Bonapartism, but not now. Anyway.
It's future episode. We'll talk about Bonaparte and Bonapartism.
Yeah, I'd like that.
I can't wait.
We should do that. Yeah. So the next question is, if you've got this guy and basically he's ruling now by brute force, by police, mm-hmm. Police rule and fiat in the government, one of the ways you can get rid of him is to resurrect this question of a sixth republic, which, if the government's going to keep on saying it's either us or the fascists, will probably be an argument that picks up a lot of steam in the coming months. I think as anger over the whole thing fails to dissipate, which I'm expecting. I think people were too engaged with this. I don't think that they found an outlet. I know you guys do the pessimist thing, and I'm probably always falling into like this category of optimism, but.
Hey, even it's like, dialectical pessimism.
Right. Sorry. Excuse me. It's dialectical pessimism.
It matters. That distinction matters a little bit.
Maybe I shouldn't have gone there. I don't want to bring up ideological fault lines or whatever. But just to say, I have been optimistic in the past, you know, and that hasn't always borne out, obviously. But
is that right?
I think with. Didn't you? But there's something, and it's not, I can't validate it, I can't verify it, but I would tell you that there's something in the air. I think when going back to the Laudon piece I shared with Julia, and I think that you guys had read the Frédéric Laudon, he gets to something. I wouldn't even raise the question of when he talks about pre-revolutionary scenarios and stuff like that, but when he captures something in that piece where he talks about just like this the curtain falling away from, say, I don't know, the right to govern from the government, right? And it happens all at once and it happens to everybody, right? And so suddenly everybody just kind of, it's like, I don't know, to use the expression, like the scales fall away from everyone's eyes. And suddenly there's, the government just doesn't seem legitimate anymore. And I think that's a sentiment that doesn't exist now just amongst us, like angry leftist losers, you know, or I mean, not losers, but, you know, people that have a grudge against society. let's put it that way, you know? Well, but it seems to be because, something that's generally shared.
Society has lost. It's not just us who are the losers anymore. It's everybody.
Right. That's a very good way to put it. I agree with that. I think there's this general sense of just like, I don't even want to put it as disillusionment because that's almost dressing it up too much. But just it's almost like I just want to say, like, it's sort of like the French word we were talking about earlier, like meh, you know, just this kind of suddenly like, huh, you know, really this profound moment of just like, yeah, no, you know, this we nobody wants this. Nobody wants to live this way. No one said you could do this to us, you know. And that has to find an expression somewhere. Now, I'm not saying it won't find an expression in Marine Le Pen. And if Marine Le Pen, fortunately, in a sense, the election isn't for another 4 years, because I think if she ran right now saying like, I'll give everyone their retirement back, I think it would be a risk people would run to get their social contract restored.
And especially when you consider that if the election was happening right now, there would still be like five parties of the left and one party of the right.
True. Yeah, right. Yeah, probably true. Now, also on that, and I feel like I've been talking a lot, but just...
That's why you are here, though.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I don't want to take... I don't know if Julie has something to say on that, too, but there's a lot of criticism. We're talking about Mélenchon and the NUPES, which is... What does NUPES stand for? Nouvelle Union de... Quelque chose. Parti Socialiste. I don't know what. Anyway, the point is that it's an agreement of leftist parties that function as an opposition in the National Assembly, even though, technically speaking, the opposition is Marine Le Pen's party. She has the second largest share. But bear in mind, nobody here has a majority, which is what got us into this mess in the first place.
It's Nouvelle Union Populaire Écologie et Sociale.
It's the new Ecological and Social People's Union.
Right.
But basically no one knows how to pronounce it. So it's like NUPES, NUPES. I think it tells a lot about, you know, I mean, it did work, you know, a little bit for the legislative election. At least they managed to get more votes than it would have normally. But it's been pretty fragile, actually. Yeah.
It has been fragile.
Sounds like almost like an insult, like a bunch of noobs, you know? Just not serious,
right?
At least not to an American.
But I think to the criticism is that because again everybody's got some reason that they don't like Mélenchon or Mélenchon isn't doing well or whatever. One of the criticisms I read here in France was that NUPES have straitjacketed him. He's lost his independence or his ability to operate independently because he's got to hold this fragile agreement together in the French National Assembly. That being said, I think that when you're faced with either Macron or the Rassemblement National, like straitjacketing yourself into a union against these dreadful alternatives probably makes a lot of sense. That's probably not something that's being, I can't imagine this is something that crosses over into the
United
States. Sort of, right? This is what's happening over here. One thing that just popped into my mind about these different French groupuscules or whatever is going back to the May Day March, anecdotally and just for fun, was, again, we arrived late, but the march was still leaving, you know? And we were standing around and we're like trying to figure out like how we're going to get into the crowd and like step into the street, you know, to join the march or whatever. And I realized suddenly I looked up and I see all of these Lutte Ouvrière signs or flags, which is the old Trotskyist group. And I thought, oh, okay, Lutte Ouvrière.
You got really excited about joining them.
Just because you know, like, I felt like I knew so many times I go to these marches, I end up marching with just like a union that I happen to, you know, end up in the line next to or whatever. I was like, oh, Ludwig, yeah, cool. Anyway, so we joined the war.
I was part of a trot sect for like 10 years.
You know? A moment of familiarity or whatever. And also it's like when we used to do marches in the ISO, it would be like us and maybe 10 comrades and, you know, our contacts, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this was literally hundreds of people with their flags and their newspapers and the whole thing or whatever, right?
Dozens.
That was a lot of people. It wasn't dozens. It was more than that. Hundreds. 2.3 million people in the streets, guys. 2.3 million. Anyway.
That's a lot of people, man.
Well, yeah, right. Not 2.3 million trots, thankfully, because it turns out.
That would be 48.3 billion sects.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But the funny thing was, is like, I'm 42 years old, and I think I was below the median age of like the Lutuvia marches because everybody there was over 60.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's the age of trots everywhere in the world is over 60 or under 30. And you're in the middle.
Right. Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah. And we ended up getting behind because, again, of course, they had like this old beat up pickup truck or something like that with this sound system set up in the back that was like turned up to 11. And this old lady chanting in the front seat, which is this horrible, shrill voice, like going through these French chants that nobody was taking up because it sounded terrible going through a bad sound system. And it was kind of difficult to understand her anyway, you know. So
now, I always liked the bad chant leader.
Yeah,
who would, never get the cadence right. People could never follow along. Go way too fast.
That's what this was.
Too many words.
Right. Amplified, yeah. Like very, very loud. So you couldn't escape it. Ahead of us was the CNT, which is like, it's the anarchist union. It's kind of like DSA 2.0 back in the aughts. It's not the CNT from the 30s. I don't know. Maybe it's part of the same legacy. I don't know. But whatever. It's not the same now. But they were playing punk music. And so I kept on trying to get kind of ahead to be with the cool kids with the Mohawks and the good music. But somehow we kept on getting caught up by the Lutuvière people.
It's kind of a metaphor for life.
It kind of really was, right?
Yeah.
And so instead, you just start marching slowly to let the yellow get ahead of us, you know?
Yeah.
And then we found ourselves like in a group of NPA. Which were younger, better chanters, fewer of them. And they were singing like old leftist songs or whatever. So I felt a little bit better about that, you know, sort of going along with that. We felt like a little bit more, and suddenly we found ourselves in like this glitter bomb milieu of like the Gen Z space communist crowd, you know, who were playing like
LGBTQIA.
Yeah, like playing like music. Yeah. With instead of like waving red flags, all their flags were like that insulation material. You know, it's like if you're in shock, they wrap you in.
Oh yeah, the shiny kind of silver. Yeah.
Right, those were their flags that they were waving up and down the streets. You know, whatever.
Wait, is that like a symbol of something?
I don't know. I think it's Gen Z space communism. They're the rainbow flag with the sickle and hammer over it or something like that. So the point of what I told Julie and our friends at the time is like we've traveled through this dimension of like from the old school Trotskyist left represented by 60-year-olds, you know, and slowly went backward forward in time and arrived in with the Gen Z youth. And so we crossed the spectrum of leftist petri dish. but it was, you know, it was cool.
Yeah.
It was cool.
I mean, yeah, it sounds cool.
Yeah.
It sounds like, I mean, it just sounds nice that people are actually getting together with common purpose. It's like when that happens here, it's so disaggregated. Everything's so fractured.
Yeah.
And like, well,
it also barely happens here.
It barely happens here. Like the closest thing would be the George Floyd protests, which were
3 years ago.
Depending on where you were, like I imagine there was common purpose in some places, but really, I mean, there's no kind of organization to give anything any kind of direction. Right, there's no kind of leadership, and even with the DSA where there was specifically not taking leadership roles in the movement because of how overwhelmingly white the DSA was in the middle of the George Floyd movement. You know,
yeah.
So it's nice to see that you know that can still happen.
I haven't like this again. To my reference was the immigrant rights marches back in 2006, 2007, and 2008 or around that.
Yeah. 2006 it was the big one, the Day Without an Immigrant March.
Right. Yeah, that one. Yeah, we were. The other, because I remember the Mike Brown, the Mike Brown demonstrations in, or was that outside of St. Louis? And it was the same. It was this mean air. It wasn't. I mean, for one thing, it was demonstration against something against police violence and murder, but there wasn't a sense of we're going to go out and we're going to accomplish something. There was this. It was chaotic and scary.
Yeah. That's what the George Floyd thing appears to have been in most places: chaotic and scary.
Yeah. That's how it was built.
Yeah.
But that was my last protest in the States.
So what are, just to wrap things up, really, like moving forward, is there any recourse other than just general revolt? Really, like. Are there any channels that anyone could go through? Is there a hope of overturning this without overturning Macron?
No,
no.
That's a short answer.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I'd say not without overthrowing Macron. No. I mean, there's the idea that you know they could rescind the law or something like that. And I think they'd very much like to contain the debate and any action on it to the National Assembly and keep it off the streets. But no, Julie is absolutely right. The short answer is like, as long as you've got Macron,
and probably
you've got this law.
Most people feel that way too, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. For sure.
So maybe the next election is going to be, you know, the most important election of your lifetime.
That's so scary.
Maybe. Yeah.
Well, one thing I've definitely learned in my 20 years of being old enough to vote, God, that makes me sound so old, doesn't it? Is that every single election is the most important election of my lifetime. And everything is just about the same as it was before, after. So I don't know.
Right. Yeah. But from that point to this one, worse. Like
yes.
from 20 years ago, my first election was 2000. God, that was awful. It was 2000. It was
2000.
Yeah. We're the same age. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. We're the same age. That was my first election.
One
yeah.
major difference for us, though, is that after and before an election or whatever, we can't try to be in the union march and then drift through the old communist march and end up in the Gen Z space communist march.
Right. Yeah.
And so really the only thing that we can do is yell at each other on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's our participation in the political process other than, you know, pressing the button that says Democrat or Republican.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
You, I don't know. I don't want to make it sound like I'm, longing for parliamentarism or anything like that, because obviously parliamentarism has its own flaws, but, the idea that you can organize that, I mean, that even having a leftist candidate like Mélenchon is even possible is just something we can't even conceive of.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the closest we had is, you know, Bernie Sanders's milquetoast diet.
Yeah.
New
I don't
deal
know if you've ever had milquetoast, but it's, you know, it's all soggy and it's not very good.
So what's the purpose of toasting it? If you just put milk on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Asking the deep important questions here.
Yeah.
Actually, this is all French toast, so I don't know if there's a metaphor.
Well, French toast is good. Do French people actually eat French toast?
Yeah, we call it pain perdu, lost bread.
Okay. Yeah. Because we call a lot of things French here that are certainly not French.
No,
so
this is French.
It's hard to tell. Well,
wait, is that the note that we're going to end on?
No. What about French kissing? Did the French really invent that?
I want to say yes. I want to believe it, yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks.
got